Today's episode of the Rewind Design Podcast is being brought to you by the Think Boyd Real Estate Team. The team of Nicole and Jeff believe that buying or selling real estate is more than just a transaction. It's a connection that should feel like working with family. For their local perspective and sage advice, if you're thinking of buying or selling, Think Boyd, part of Royal LePage Team Advantage Realty Brokerage Inc., Think Boyd Real Estate Team. Everybody, and welcome to Rewind Design Cottage History Podcast. My name is Katie McNabb, and I'm a registered interior designer here in Cottage Country with my own studio called Rewind Design Studio, which is a full-service interior design and architectural consultation firm located in the heart of Parry Sound. I am so excited for this episode. I've been waiting a while to post this one, but cannot wait. On this week's episode, we have a special guest from the Georgian Bay Biosphere, Mindo Gami, Executive Director Becky Pollock. So I couldn't be more excited to share this episode with you. We have a series of, I think, four episodes with the Georgian Bay Biosphere planned, this one with Becky, and then we have three consecutive episodes with Katrina and Tiana, and we speak about environmental concerns about cottaging on the Georgian Bay region, specifically our impacts on the shoreline. And we have another episode with Benjamin John about energy, specifically the energy impact of cottaging in Georgian Bay, as well as better use of energy, different types of green energy, solar, geothermal, heat pumps, all sorts of great conversations with Ben. I will also be interviewing Becky's co-executive manager, Greg Mason, the Biosphere's director of operations. So stay tuned for the next three episodes about the Biosphere, in addition to this one with Becky. The interview is wonderful, so I'm not going to take too much time in this intro, but you can also check out the blog at rewinddesign.ca to read more about the Biosphere and what they do. You can go to their website at www.georgianbaybiosphere.com. For more information. Without further ado, let's get right into the episode with Becky. I'm really excited for today's interview. We've got Becky here from the Georgian Bay Biosphere, and we'll get into more about the Biosphere in a second. But I really wanted to start off with, if you can say your full name, who you are, what you do, and what your position is here at the Biosphere.
My name's Becky Pollock. I'm the executive director of the Georgian Bay Mindo Gami Biosphere, and I work with an incredible team here. I co-manage the Biosphere with Greg Mason, our director of operations. I personally was born in Ottawa and grew up in the Kitchener-Waterloo area and went to University of Waterloo for my undergraduate studies and then Trent and Carleton for graduate studies. But most of all, I'm a cottager in the Codnachene area, and I've spent every summer of my life there on the hot rocks and smelling the sweet pine needles. So I have a really deep connection, and I really like to say that Georgian Bay is in my blood, because really, you know, when you're out there, you just feel it. We like to acknowledge that the Georgian Bay Mindo Gami, or Great Lake of the Spirit Biosphere, is situated within the territory of the Anishinaabeg, and that it's also situated within the Robinson-Huron Treaty of 1850, and to the south of us, the Williams Treaties of 1923. And out of respect for my Indigenous colleagues, Anishinaabeg youth teachers, I'd like to try to introduce myself in Anishinaabe Mo'in, or the Ojibwe language. So I would say, Ani, Bojo, Beki Indigenakaz, Kata Kenzi Endo Dem, Nobel Ndonjaba, Canadian, Scottish Ndao, Georgian Bay Mindo Gami, Ndonjianaki, Miigwech. So I just said where I was from, that I live in Nobel, that I don't know my clan, that I'm of Canadian and Scottish descent, and that I work for the Georgian Bay Biosphere. We're very, very proud of the Biosphere region. And that's the first thing to understand, is that the Biosphere is part of a world network of UNESCO sites. So that's United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. So UNESCO, you may have heard of the World Heritage program. So World Heritage includes Lunenburg, Nova Scotia, Quebec City. And so they have a sister program called World Biosphere Reserves, or what we now call Biosphere Regions. There's over 700 sites in well over, 150 countries. And this program was established in 1970 when the real goal of conservation biology was to protect core areas that represented unique ecosystems. So we can think of Georgian Bay Biosphere as what makes it unique. Well, we're the world's largest freshwater archipelago. So this so-called 30,000 islands region has great ecological importance on the planet, something to be proud of as a region. But the process for designating these UNESCO World Biosphere sites is quite rigorous. And on average, certainly in Canada, the process takes about 5 to 7 years. So when we talk about the history of how our eastern Georgian Bay coast, and it's from the Severn River near Honey Harbour, Port Severn, all the way up to the French River, that kind of takes in about 7 major rivers. The boundary extends west of the Limestone Islands, but it follows the old Highway 69 corridor, sort of north-south. On our maps to UNESCO, the designation does not go east of the highway corridor, but the real functional value is that we work outside of those boundaries all the time. We work across the school board with dozens of schools. We work across down to Midland and Collingwood with marinas. We're working, regionally with the Muskoka Watershed Council. So there's a lot of partnerships to our north, south, and east that are really meaningful for our work. But that's the other thing, is that the biosphere is both a region, World Biosphere Site. Geographically, you can think of that as a landscape. And we are a charitable, not-for-profit organization. What's confusing is we're both called the biosphere.
Yes. But it's two separate.
Well, what we are considered internationally, the managers or holders, coordinators really, of the UNESCO mandate here in our region. And so there are 19 World Biosphere Regions in Canada. So everything from Fundy Biosphere, Nova Scotia,
East Coast,
New Brunswick, to the Clockwood Sound Biosphere Trust, which is a biosphere designated in the New Chalnuth territory on the West Coast. And so our network is a very diverse, robust network of volunteer-based organizations. And so we fit right into that. We've learned a lot from our members, but we also are very grassroots. And so, like I said, it took volunteers here on the eastern coast of Georgian Bay, starting with volunteers from the Georgian Bay Association of Cottagers, particularly Pat Northey, a real visionary and driver, working with cottagers, residents, First Nations, and boaters to kind of come together around that table and say, we want this for the region. And that was in 1996.
Okay, so it hasn't really been that long.
Well, 25 years since they incorporated, and then grew the slow, steady growth of, I'd say, the awareness of what a biosphere is. But we weren't, I should be clear that we were designated a biosphere in 2004. Which makes next year our official 20th anniversary as a world network. We're planning a party. We're looking for volunteers. Okay. So yeah, the landscape is the one piece, and then the work of the organization is the other. Yeah.
And I don't know if you said this already, but what defines what a biosphere is?
For me and for the UNESCO World Network, we're looking at sites that are demonstrations in both conservation of biodiversity and sustainable development. So the tagline is people and nature in balance. And what's most misleading, I think, is people think of a biosphere reserve, that old word reserve, as a nature reserve, a park, a protected area. That's
that people just aren't involved in it.
Such a misleading term. So biosphere region is about a living landscape. It's about understanding people's livelihoods. And my belief is that a biosphere doesn't function without a strong sense of place, because the caretaking ethic from both cottaging perspective, that intergenerational aspect, or protecting an area you love for future generations. The idea that we've been taught by Anishinaabeg people here about 7 generations, this idea of caretaking and reciprocity of the land, which sustains us. The ideas of sustainability, sustainable economic development. It's about, preserving resources. So all of those kind of ethics come together, but in a particular place. And the strength of the biosphere model, Katie, is that it's not prescriptive. So it's not a blueprint. It's highly values-based work that has to be applied. It works context specifically. So your partners really have to define their priorities. And we're very, very lucky in this area to have a high level of conservation already occurring. I mean, almost 75% of our landscape, which is unusual for a biosphere region, is essentially in a conservation kind of role, whether that's one of the six provincial parks, our national park, all the land trust properties. We consider a high biodiversity on First Nations as well. So all of these different sort of, let's call them, you know, layers of jurisdiction and protection are functioning as a whole system. We're so lucky here.
There's one thing that you said that I really relate to. And one of the reasons why I wanted to interview the biosphere is for this second season of the podcast, I've been speaking to a lot of mainly designers and architects, landscapers, this type of thing about sustainability. And obviously everyone has a different perspective on what is sustainability because it's such a broad topic. Like, what does it mean? So that's something we talk about a lot because everyone has a different perspective, especially from a building standpoint. And so I love what you're saying about the biosphere being an organization that isn't just, it's not a reserve. It's not looking at it and saying no one can touch the environment. And my perspective is from a building standpoint, it's having the least impact possible and living kind of harmoniously with the nature that's there, which is my end goal, working with builders, mainly building. It's like, how can we be building better?
Absolutely. That's one of our messages is around it doesn't really matter what sector you're in, sort of you can always find those best practices. And that's why we can, that's why sustainability is the journey, not the destination. We all talk about this. And for us as well, it's not just about balance and good use of resources and stewardship, those kinds of ethics. It's about equity as well and inclusion. So one of the founders of the Biosphere talked about a lot of money flowing through Parry Sound area, but not a lot of it stays. And this is just the nature of cottage country, but it's also a dynamic across Canada where some of the most beautiful areas are becoming, you know, for the most privileged. We have to really work to be aware of that and to think strategically about how do we meet all our goals. So that's about, it's not trade-offs to me. It's about mutually beneficial strategies around equity and inclusion and how do we build these bridges. And so if we have a minute to talk about Georgian Bay Bias for the organization.
Of course.
So it was, as I mentioned, founded in 1998. With the vision that they would one day become designated by UNESCO, which they did in 2004. And at that time, they had a group of very dedicated volunteers and they believed in networks. Their idea was that we were a big tent for all of these different interest groups. This was not about us and them. This was not about environmentalists against development. This is about an inclusion-based way where we all share a sense of place. We all want to protect it for future generations, but we all want to live and benefit from the area. So how do we do that well? And, you know, we're looking to other models. Biospheres are meant to be other models. We're striving to be one ourselves. But that's about really creating those strong networks. So Katie, what we did in the beginning is we called ourselves a table for the conversation. One of the first initiatives we did was we met with a whole group of educators that included teachers and college professors and First Nation teachers and healers and others, you know, kindergarten adult learners. And we said, hi, we're the Biosphere. What can we do for you? And they all said, we want more outdoor education. We want more nature-based learning. We have no money for busing. And so we said, how can we do this? And we developed a whole suite of lessons in a backpack that are literally meant to use outside the schoolyard. It's a walking field trip. You're using your schoolyard because the schoolyards here have beautiful rock barrens where you can study skink habitat. They have like wetlands where you can go and see biodiversity. So we were taking the problem of like nature education and resource, you know, shortage and kind of turning it on its head. And we've created a suite of over, you know, 40 lesson plans that have been downloaded 40,000 times. So that's an example of sort of hearing the need of the community and reaching out through our education mandate. And my second favorite example is in 2005, we met with what we called conservation stakeholders to hold a meeting at Kilbear Park. And I think there were about 25 or 30 people at the time. And we basically went around the room and said, who's doing what on this landscape? Some are researchers, some are monitoring, some are parks, some are education. And we tried to figure out sort of what were the collective priorities. And we had these annual meetings and they just began to grow and grow. And we narrowed down the need that there was a lot of research happening on the bay, but none of it was really being well communicated to the public. And we said, oh, we're a biosphere. We can do, you know, science communication. So that's how State of the Bay was born.
And that's what I know, not that I know most about the biosphere, but I know that you really are educating the public. Whereas like some of these other, I don't want to say like organizations, maybe it doesn't have as much advertising to the client on what, not to the client, advertising to the public on what you're doing. And I find so many more people are aware of things because of the State of the Bay report, some of the other publications that you put out. There, what's the one I was talking to
Life on the Bay.
Life on the Bay is so good.
Stewardship guide. Really practical.
Yes. So practical, so helpful, so user-friendly. And I'm trying to get people to use them because they're so helpful, especially the building ones for me.
Good.
So again, all of these are linked in the show notes.
Yeah, it's quite a long list now.
I know.
I'm really proud to be part of a 20-year-old organization. That's going to be a great cake next year.
I know.
And so what I would say is back to that table for the conversation is we felt, because we're non-advocacy, we're not an issues-based organization, mainly because we're charity, but also because we really think there's power in being a little more neutral and bringing parties to this table to discuss conflicting or differing viewpoints. It is at the heart of sustainability or sustainable development, which is we have to have a conversation because wind power for some ruins a landscape and has environmental impacts, and wind power for others is a really important solution to climate change. So how do you bring those viewpoints together, and are there places where it's appropriate to do those things? So we believe, yes, there's always these kinds of solutions and mutual benefits. So being that table for the conversation is important, but equally so, building those networks of partnerships. And in the early days, we sort of saw ourselves as like this spider in the web, right? The State of the Bay researchers kind of bringing all that together and knowing who was doing what. Same with education. We tried to work with all of the schools, and the program lessons in a backpack was so effective that our board said, what about kids in the summer? And so that's what created Kids in the Biosphere, which is a whole program of its own with a summer blog. And at this point in time, it's completely made possible by a subsidy by a township of the archipelago for its cottagers and families. So we have up to 300 families participate each summer in this idea that they're out exploring the landscape. Let's just, you know, we're all out there catching frogs as kids. Let's just, you know, add a little more science, add a little bit more of the equipment to become a citizen scientist, to increase our knowledge. Because I think when we were kids, we were always looking at like dragonflies that were hatching and things like that. So it's really about harnessing that joy and love and saying, oh, well, do these kids know that they're in a world biosphere? Can we bring that to their attention and instill that sense of joy and pride?
And also, it's like, it's one way as a kid looking at all these things and being really interested and curious, but then to know the science behind it and why it's important and why all of these little tiny insects really impact the whole, you know, the whole cycle of everything.
We're very excited to be working with youth and families as much as we can, but that is one of the areas of our mandate where there are consistently low resources. Mm-hmm. So, for example, governments won't fund anything during school because that's considered a Ministry of Education type of expense, and we're sort of value added. So we are trying to find creative ways to get kids outdoors, and then once they're there, engage them. So the bio blitzes are a relatively new, I think, concept for people where we're leveraging the power of technology with apps such as iNaturalist. Mm-hmm. So that's a free app. I'm sure you'll learn more about it or link it. But the iNaturalist, we've had well over 6,000 volunteers reporting sightings and identifying more than 5,000 species. Individual unique species. We never had that ability before this tool to have that many eyes on the ground.
Enough feet on the ground.
No, I mean, it's a scientist's dream to have this level of, you know, reporting of sightings and then also abundance. And individual universities will follow up with community partners to say, hey, you had this species sighted. Can you tell us more about that? And it creates the basis for new knowledge and new research. So we're taking this iNaturalist tool, we're putting it in the hands of all ages, and we're creating a BioBlitz event, which is really a mass fun inventory of biodiversity. And it could be for a week or a day. It could be like just birds or just plants. But the idea is just to get people more, I think, in touch with. I remember through COVID, our family saw more birds and mushrooms than ever. Mm-hmm. It's because we're giving it the time.
Because it's always been here. Yeah. Here all the time.
Yeah. So there is this really neat multi-beneficial from science value to education to engagement. We're creating stewardship ethics that are go deeper than people's sense of place. We have a tremendous staff. So we've seen lately that really the work on reptiles and amphibians that we've done for the past 15 or so years, what used to be a narrower portfolio under the Species at Risk Act and some funding to do education and awareness on, you know, turtles and snakes, has really morphed into a long-term, rigorous, evidence-based project around maintaining turtle populations so that they're viable. They're so threatened. Their lifespans are very
And what do you
precarious? The road networks are such a threat. We have to actively mitigate that threat. We can't just say, oh, we'll move a few turtles off the road. It has to be much more than that.
Would you say is the main threat the road systems, or what other threats are?
Oh, yeah, this is a great question. I get this a lot. So from State of the Bay, and when we look at Georgian Bay, it is a relative wilderness to a lot of us. It's absolutely beautiful. I'm a cottager myself, many generations, and have that privilege. We look at that space and we think it's so eternal and so beautiful and pristine. The reality is it's facing a lot of the same pressures as the other Great Lakes. And those pressures are invasive species, both aquatic and terrestrial.
And what are a few species? Can you name a few?
Quickly, zebra mussels and quagga mussels, their relative, have done an absolute game changer on the ecosystem.
And don't people think that they're kind of disappearing because now they've just actually gone deeper?
They have gone deeper. We have that information now. Yeah. So we are looking at Georgian Bay from the invasive species perspective. They're here. They're coming. It is virtually impossible to eradicate most of them. So we now need to adapt. Well, what does that look like? So the first one is invasive species. The second big, big pressure is climate change. And that will affect everything. And so we can talk about that. And then the third one is that in certain areas, there are localized development impacts. I'm a strong believer that best practices, good development, setbacks can all be developed. There are a lot of examples of really good development. But when we're starting to talk about shorelines and near water systems, we have to take those extra precautions. And so, you know, that's where working with building departments and educating between the vision of the community for what they want. And if you really value loons and good water quality, then there are certain steps we have to take within our own development practices, including, new roads. We have to ask ourselves, what are those tipping points? There is a biologist who talks about death by a thousand cuts. The tree won't feel one cut. It won't feel another. But collectively, over time, we have to take a perspective that every little individual action has either, it's not neutral.
Mm-hmm.
You can have collective impact on climate change by taking individual steps. Absolutely, there's evidence for that. But likewise, those little tiny instances with our local environment can damage, right? Those little biological creatures. So we're trying to build relationships and awareness much more around an Anishinaabeg land ethic now. This is my learning edge, Katie, and our organization, our name changed in 2020 out of respect for the first people here, their land, their territory, the Anishinaabeg. Our organization is learning Anishinaabe Mo'in. So that used to be called the Ojibwe language. And so we have been working hard to acknowledge that the treaties, the original landholders, some of those original agreements between humans and nature that need to be honored in this culture, and also bringing in the language into our work. So whenever we can, we try to introduce ourselves in Anishinaabe Mo'in. And we have held a cultural advisory circle very informally at first in 2008. It was a number of women that came to the biosphere from area First Nations, including Wasaksing and Shawanaga, and said, we want to know more about the biosphere. We also work in the schools. We'd like to work with you. So it was mutual learning and really, really wonderful. And so that cultural advisory circle now exists more formally as an advisory to our board. And it was them that in 2020 brought forward the idea that our name, Georgian Bay Biosphere Reserve, Inc., should really be changed to reflect the local language and sense of place. And so there are multiple names for Georgian Bay in the language. And one of them is Great Lake of the Spirit. And so Minido Gami, or Gami, is that name. And so we changed our name legally and officially to Georgian Bay Minido Gami Biosphere. And so that will be honored by UNESCO next year. We would recognize within the biosphere, we would recognize seven, including the newer arrival of Moose Jaw Point First Nation, as well as the relocation of the Wata Mohawk to the Bala area. So there's the traditional Anishinaabeg communities in the corridor, we would say, along Georgian Bay. And then we also acknowledge Chimnasing or Beausoleil First Nation to the south, and the Wikwimakong and several others on Manitoulin Island. So we're surrounded by really rich Indigenous cultures that through our work committed to UNESCO, but also to UNDRIP, to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, we as citizens of the world are called to honor Indigenous rights first and foremost, no questions asked. And so that includes their sovereignty, self-governance, self-determination, huge amounts of respect for a nation-to-nation relationship, But you can't reconcile, as we're being called to do, without that relationship. How do you have reconciliation in Canada without building a relationship? A lot of pieces. It's an intergenerational journey for sure. And so we have a responsibility to do that work. One of our commitments is to creating safe space and leadership space for Indigenous youth to take forward. So the Georgian Bay Anishinaabeg Youth is actually one of our major programs now. And the GBay, I know there's a lot of GBs out there, but GBay, Georgian Bay Anishinaabeg Youth, if you haven't followed them on Instagram yet, you need to see what they're up to. They're doing incredible land-based learning to reweave and reconnect youth with their culture, their communities, with each other, and with a sense of belonging.
Can I get you to maybe explain quickly first of all, how many people do you have on your team?
For sure.
And maybe just kind of the different departments that work within the organization.
Absolutely. That's a relatively new concept for us, this idea of departments. We still call them program teams.
Okay.
And so from the earliest days when we were, first volunteers, my co-director of operations, Greg Mason, and I both have served on the previous founding board, and Greg longer than myself because he's a local Parry Sound boy. I'm a cottager from Cognoshine Cottage area, which is a wonderful privilege. And so we have these connections as residents and cottagers. So we really have this, sort of complex view of how these different groups work together. But in that role, leading a team, and then we grew to become a team of five, our focus was on education, right, with schools, but also that conservation work with species at risk. And we did a lot of snakes and turtles and worked with cottagers primarily. As that evolved, we've really, I think, exploded over the past 10 years. And that is to say that we have five major program areas. They are lands and waters for all of that wonderful conservation work, but that's also landscape work with First Nations and municipalities as well. We have an education department. We're currently trying to revision what our role and approach is for really reaching youth. I think there's different ways, particularly with climate action. The third one is our cultural programming, and that includes a home for the Georgian Bay Anishinaabeg youth, but also building bridges with First Nations and bringing in Indigenous knowledge holders into our work. And the fourth one is climate. Mm-hmm. So that's what we call a climate and energy program area, and that's been a major effort. I'm really proud of the work that our communities have done on climate so far. It's very bureaucratic in some ways, getting municipalities, to work together and with First Nations, but we've created one of the first, I think, frameworks in Canada to bring together those different jurisdictions within a landscape to set targets for emissions reduction. So this is great work that's happening through ICECAP and through all of those partners.
Yes.
So I would say those are the five main ones. Cross-cutting programs. I mean, climate change weaves through everything. We take a cultural relationship building lens through everything we do. Every element of our work has to involve education, right? And it's really funny. We were doing a review. We're audited by UNESCO every 10 years. And in 2014, they did some interviews, their reviewers on the ground, and people said, oh yeah, the biosphere has been doing education for a decade, basically teaching people what is a biosphere and you live in one. Mm-hmm. And maybe how you can get involved. But it has been sort of this major effort to create this base level of awareness that we are in a very special region. And I feel really proud about that because I think we've achieved awareness of a certain level, but not just that, engagement. And we can tell because we have over 220 partner organizations and, we've got a $2 million organization, and that's something that the community has created. So the biosphere is theirs, Katie. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sit in this office. I mean, I understand it's a plaque on the wall from UNESCO and a handshake. Good luck. There's no resources that come with that. We're all grassroots based in Canada. Okay. Now, there is some commitment now to recently federal funding for this landscape conservation work, which is fabulous. We want that to continue because we build partnerships with all the area, actors for that work. But ultimately we are building this as a grassroots initiative. Yeah. We're an experiment in sustainable development is what these models is called. But people will ask, are we a model for sustainable development?
Like,
I don't see it through that lens. I just doubt I'm looking for models outside of our area, but I know other biospheres look to us as a model.
And where would you look to as an example of a model sustainable biosphere?
For my own organizational inspiration, I looked to two sites in Canada that I'm familiar with. I'm not as familiar with all of them, so I'll apologize.
You can't be familiar with everything. No.
But I mean, from my days as a researcher and as a student, I looked to the West Coast. There's a number of reasons why the Clockwood Sound Biosphere Trust has been so successful. And one of them was that it was born out of conflict. It was born out of Canada's largest civil arrests during the old growth harvest battles, battles in the woods, they were called. And so Clockwood Sound was at the heart of that international media attention. And the Chrétien Liberal government at the time in Canada basically endorsed this. They expedited a biosphere application. They granted the biosphere a $12 million endowment fund to manage for life. And they brought stakeholders together in a stakeholder model, which actually had seats for each one of the five new Chalnuth tribes. So there was a lot of co-governance built, baked in to the model for the region. And they've worked really hard at that. They're more like a granting foundation, and they sponsor sort of small community initiatives, but they have a very robust research network. And so for me, for my work, I look to what they're doing because their partnerships have been so successful, and also the work they're doing with Indigenous Partnership. On the other hand, I look to for sort of innovation and social enterprise and a new way of doing business. I look to Quebec because there's the biosphere, you might know this, Crater Lake. It's a perfectly shaped circle. It was caused by a meteor, I guess. So if you look at Baie-Comeau on the St. Lawrence River, go north, and it's called the Manicouagan Uapishka Biosphere. It is within Innu territory and designated as one of the biospheres in Quebec. And they started out in a model that would bring mining and logging, which was actively happening. You might have heard of tinfoil, aluminum foil. Alcoa is one of the biggest mining companies based in that biosphere. And you think, how can you have mining in a biosphere? This is the perfect example of how do you push companies to be more responsible corporate citizens. And so Alcoa granted a $25 million endowment to their region to invest in sustainable planning for the community. And so every year the community designs and votes on projects that they want to lead, whether it's a recycling project in the community or whether it's a new outdoor trail system. It's a pretty neat model. And the biosphere itself hasn't been a not-for-profit in the same way. They started as a consulting firm and they now have offices in Montreal and Quebec City. As a biosphere, they're taking their brand and way of doing business, which is bringing sort of what are traditionally opposing views into the same room around the same table to do sustainable development. It's inspiring.
You mentioned that you were a generational cottager in Cogwashene, which is very cool. Do you still have a cottage in that area?
We do. Yeah. Okay. We have a family cottage. I was born in Ottawa and then we moved when I was seven to Waterloo. So I grew up in Kitchener-Waterloo. But every summer of my life, I've been at the cottage. And that's in Cognoshene on Burnt Island. It's just absolutely beautiful. And it's part of, a little bay of four family cottages. Prior to being on Burnt Island, my maternal great-grandmother had a cottage on Christian Island. In 1885 is when that was first registered. And we have some beautiful photographs from that time. And they're treasures now to understand that family's connection. They were from Collingwood. And so, the Burney family from Collingwood, old Mrs. Burney would have been at the Burnt Island place that was built finally in 1926. And so we keep it standing. It could really use, a sustainable builder's touch.
Yeah.
But it's truly authentic. Like we are, like everyone, power got put in the 50s. A water line got put in the 80s. We're still on an outhouse set way back in the woods. And that's how we like it. We love it rustic and we go there as a pure retreat. It's really neat to see cottages that have resisted,
there's still a lot.
That's right. That sort of natural evolution to modernization in terms of taking a stand on sustainability and saying, this is where we come to connect with nature. And so why don't we keep it that way without it falling down, of course. It's one thing to think about your ecological actions. It's another to think about this culture, this idea of bringing, modern culture out. And when we think about our ancestors, for those of us like my family who were settlers, early Canadians had this recreational privilege for the most part. And yet they were a huge intrusion into the colonial project of Canada. I always think about my ancestry and how much my ancestors knew about the treaty making process that was happening around them and under them.
Where did your family come from?
So, you know, originally probably Scotland, England.
Yeah.
But they, even arriving into Collingwood, that idea that it was, you know, virgin timber and they were putting in, it was after the War of 1812. So mm-hmm. everything was, you know, finally open for development. And
in the logging industry.
Yeah, lumber mills set up shop and then railways. And we all understand, I mean, the Parry Sound itself has an incredible history of being in the sort of the eye of that storm
100%.
In terms of Canada's development. So really taking a cultural lens as we look at how we develop into the future will be important for reconciliation mm-hmm. to really learn about all of our relations, as they say, all of our non-human kin, thinking about the trees and the rocks through that lens of culture.
So I understand that the biosphere is actually situated within both the Robinson-Huron Treaty of 1850 and the Williams Treaty of 1923. So I see how the biosphere being situated on both of these treaties would affect your work in the biosphere and the way that you interact with the land itself and the peoples. I just wanted to understand what the GBB might be doing to help teach people about these treaties.
There's no right place to start. It's, you know, for you, it's design. Mm-hmm. For other people, it's gardening or food. Mm-hmm. For other people, it's, you know, fast fashion and making a commitment to repairing clothing mm-hmm. or sewing clothes or, you know, thrift stores. So there's always ways. And that's, I think, the hope in this work has to be central to our work. There's days I'm a realist. I'm also a cynic. I think that helps my reality perception, but I also have this immense hope and optimism for our species that we can do better. I definitely went through a phase as a younger child, a young woman at the cottage, thinking about what I could do for Georgian Bay. And I remember when I was 14 years old, I applied to work at the International Joint Commission. I just sent them a letter, right? The Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement was part something I studied. And I thought, oh, I could work for these people because I was very interested in politics and environmental policy. And so that went nowhere. They didn't even answer my letter, IJC, if you're listening. And from there, I took jobs in provincial parks. I actually worked a beautiful job at the national park at Bosley Island, where my grandfather could come out in his little boat and pick me up on weekends. So that was a really lovely way to stay connected with the bay. I also was a park naturalist in Killarney and then in Kildare. So for me, it was very intentional about going through school, but taking my summers in a place that I loved. And while I was open to working in Ottawa or even at UNESCO, the UN, it really came down to a choice after my PhD about whether I wanted to be in an urban context at a university, because I love ideas. I love students. I love learning. And then, of course, teaching and research is a passion. But I didn't see that life for myself because it wasn't connected to a landscape that I really loved. And my life partner wanted to be here. So we really, I think, were active in creating jobs for ourselves. But at the time, it was serendipitous. I think there's a lot of, you know, timing involved in these things in your life, Katie. And
100%.
So for me, it was really about truly respecting the board and all of those founding members that came together to say, we have a vision for this landscape and we just have to articulate that in a way that is not threatening to people and really clear that it's their place and it's about creating opportunities and also protecting it for future generations. So we were volunteers in 2002 mm-hmm. when we moved to the community. And then I was a student, Greg was a planner, a municipal planner. We did some consulting work. And finally, when the board was able to hire staff, we resigned from the board, applied jointly as the manager. And they said, well, how are we going to do this? And we said, well, it's, you know, two for the price of one. I mean, it's great. It was really, really wonderful at the time because we have complementary skill sets. So yeah, that's how we landed here. And we've just sort of taken our approach from complex systems thinking, which was a big part of our training at University of Waterloo in environment and resource studies. And we've taken that complex systems thinking into our work. And we've tried to build capacity. And I think if Greg were here, he would say the one thing that we can't communicate very well is that the secret sauce to this work is relationship building. It's the facilitation. It's brokering these partnerships. And it's easy to start a network, honestly. It takes a little effort, but it's the maintenance of that work keeping people connected. And COVID actually shattered a lot of our ongoing relationship work for a lot of reasons. And we had to reweave some of them, and still some of them haven't recovered. And we're also thinking, what are the new ones that need to be made? So we're coming up to a major 20-year visioning process in the coming year. And we want all the stakeholders and community partners to be involved in helping us see what has the Biosphere contributed over the last decade or two, where are its strengths, and what's the vision for the future, and what part of that can we help with? Because we cannot be all things to all people. So where are we going to be putting our efforts? And everyone says, where's the Biosphere Center? We need a giant biodome. We want to have a beautiful place to celebrate nature and culture.
And you're like, wait, we're in it though.
And we get phone calls to our office. Could we buy tickets to the Biosphere? Ring, ring, where's the front gate for the Biosphere? So it's an interesting concept that possibly other world biospheres have a more tourist presence or a tourist destination, or certainly an education center. A lot of them do have a more visitor friendly. Right. We're an administrative office here.
I feel like, do you just say, oh, here's where you can go rent a canoe?
No, we definitely tell them that they're in the biosphere and that it's a whole landscape to explore. A few years ago, we picked up a program from Fundy Biosphere that they'd started called Amazing Places. And we thought, oh, that makes a lot of sense. So that when visitors come, they don't really know the area. Where do they start? And for many people who don't have a boat, can't charter a boat, it's very hard. Actually, they just stand at the water's edge and say, how do we get out there? So fortunately, there are a few tour boats. But we created a list of 20 amazing places. They're self-guided. The public nominated them. They dropped pins on a Google map, and we had to immediately disqualify all the ones that didn't have any management capacity. Right. We can't recommend Crown Land for people to suddenly, you know, visit to death.
Yeah.
We have to have some controls. So there are amazing places that do include Hole in the Wall, which you can see on the Island Queen. There's, of course, provincial parks. So the Swan Lake Trail up in Grundy, the Twin Points Trail, absolutely gorgeous little 1 kilometer. And then as we go north, I mean, there's the French River Gorge itself, an incredible cultural landscape and geological landscape. We did say that because most of our biosphere to the west of us is water, we would extend the boundaries. And so I think we gave it like 100 kilometer radius. So one of our amazing places is the Cranberry Marsh, Johnson's Farm, Cranberry Farm. I think it's called Muskoka Lakes Cranberry Farm and Winery now. They have won awards for sustainable agriculture and sustainable harvest. It's a really beautiful place to visit year round.
I've actually never been.
Oh, they have all these trails. You can explore the trails. You can take
I do have a new friend that I'm starting to hang out with more that lives in Bala. So I'm like, that's perfect. Maybe we can head over that direction.
Yeah. So we do. Yeah. This is the network. I mean, you can find visitamazingplaces.ca and then visit them. But we just want people to discover the region sort of on their own terms, because we are not a tourist marketing board. We're not a tourism organization. And while we've partnered with the tourism sector, our main role is to provide guided tours and educational tours. Mm. And that's something we do. The people who come to work at the Biosphere are incredibly passionate. Many of them have a deep connection to the area already, either from childhood living here, growing up here, or cottaging. Some of them are longtime campers. They've, you know, been at a park for decades as a part of their family experience. But really, it's about these passionate people from all different walks of life coming together to do this collective work. And they bring such creativity to their work, such energy,
so much passion.
I mean, if you have been out at midnight trying to get a turtle biologist to leave a research site, you know, you understand that working with this team is a real honor, a real gift. We're really proud of being one of the area's bigger employers for a rural area, and also trying to retain youth in the quote unquote North has its challenges. We can't compete with other competitive, you know, employment packages and sort of salary points, but we do offer other benefits, and we do try to help people find housing. Yeah. I think that's the number one barrier to this work. If you want to ask the flip question,
100%,
which is, as much as I want to grow and sustain this team of young leaders, we are seeing this real desperate need for housing at every price point.
Mm-hmm.
Affordable housing is the priority. And then for all accessibility, we have to find creative ways as a community. So when we think about caretaking the community and working for people and place, what are we doing to help with sustainable housing? And how can we be leaders in that?
So one of my kind of last questions was, I know the Biosphere is huge into education and advocacy, like we've talked about. But if you're listening to this podcast and you want to get involved, what are some ways that people can can either volunteer or contribute, or what are some mm-hmm. ways?
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll start with the obvious things, which is that I mentioned you can follow us on social media. You can go on our website and subscribe to our e-newsletter. That's one way to keep up to date with all the coming events and other ways of getting involved. There's a get involved form on our website for people who want to volunteer. And we do want to ask you, you know, what are your skill sets and interests? Because that's important. But also, what kind of time can you give? So if you can only give a day a week in the summer, that's great. It's just we need to know your availability. So we'll try to find a match for a job for you. We would welcome that. And particularly, we're looking for volunteers at events that can help with the public and set up wonderful education booths and tables. But we're also looking for other tasks. We're looking for an archivist, for example, someone who can help us record our, you know, historic documents. So there's a number of get involved roles for people.
And it's best for people to reach out through the
website. Yes, through the website would be really great because it's just right there. The other one is that we welcome members all the time. And that is a membership for families, for students, for seniors, for businesses. And that's something we'd love to grow because the more that we can spread the word that you can become a member of the Biosphere, mm-hmm. it's a non-voting membership. It's really about building the community of supporters. And so we'd love that.
And I guess, sorry, what does the membership entail?
Oh gosh, the membership entails going online and paying your fee of $30, $50, or $120.
Gotcha.
And then we will automatically subscribe you. And then there's members events throughout the year as well.
Okay.
And we're trying to do more of those. So we're going to be trying to set up a schedule for the summer that sort of has more members events, and we can coordinate that. But it is a massive following. I should say that there mm-hmm. is a lot of our community that's now engaged in events. And so what we're doing is we're trying to partner with cottage associations as well, because we can't get to all 19 every summer. We don't have that many staff. And that's actually another reason we need volunteers, is so that they can take our Biosphere materials out with them to the annual meetings or the regattas, mm-hmm. The fun days that we can have our materials out there. We're still stocked fully with State of the Bay magazines. We would love to distribute those again anytime. Mm-hmm. So if you have a space in your car and you are happy to drop them off at a few places, we can get you a list. I would say that we welcome donations of any kind, Katie. We have mm-hmm. very generous donors. Some of them make monthly gifts, some at times it's once a year. Mm-hmm. And then there's other forms of contributions, including, you know, donations of stocks and securities and things like that. Mm-hmm. Those go a really long way for a charity, because we can take those personal donations, charitable donations, we can match them against government dollars again and again. So for every dollar that's donated, we can sometimes leverage that five times over. And that's again on our donate button online. And you can call me personally as well, georgianbayvisor.com. And then the events page and the news can kind of keep you covered. But again, subscribing to our email will get you there as well.
Okay.
Yeah. We look forward to meeting everyone, and we look forward to seeing everyone, and we welcome questions at any time. Just reach out.
Very loving atmosphere here. And then just to finish off this conversation, there was this one quote on your website that really spoke to me. And I know we have talked a lot about this, but the quote is, "The Bay is an amazing resource we must share, seasonal cottager, transient tourist, and year-rounders. And we must all respect the Bay to ensure the next seven generations mm-hmm. will have the good fortune to be amazed like we were."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one mm-hmm. little quote actually does encapsulate a lot of the mandates of the Biosphere.
Mm-hmm. And I think that aligns with the UNESCO vision of long-term sustainability. So it's that balance of people and nature, but taking care of people and place together. So it's great work. I mean, I couldn't think of a better job, really.
I know. And I can tell you're so passionate. And I mean, it shows so clearly that you love what you do. So
yeah,
thank you so much for taking the time to answer all these questions. And yeah.
My pleasure.
So exciting. And of course, everything that we spoke about will be linked below. And you can also check out their website, which is
georgianbayvisor.com.
Today's episode was brought to you by the Think Boyd Real Estate Team. The team of Nicole and Jeff believe that buying or selling real estate is more than just a transaction. It's a connection that should feel like working with family. For their local perspective and sage advice, if you're thinking of buying or selling, think Boyd. part of Royal LePage, Team Advantage, Realty Brokerage, Inc., Think Boyd Real Estate Team. If you enjoyed this week's episode, thank you so much for listening. If you would like to support the podcast further, you can like and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon, wherever you're listening to the podcast, so you can get regular updates and notifications when a new podcast is released. You can follow me on Instagram at rewind.design. That's what it is. You can also sign up to my newsletter on my website, www.rewinddesign.ca. Thank you so much.